Shapiro is co-founder of the Better Meat Company and a prominent figure in alt proteins. His early work in food advocacy led him towards entrepreneurship and a focus on pragmatic solutions. In this interview, he discusses the barriers to scaling up novel proteins and how, by harnessing biomass fermentation technology to produce mycelium mycoproteins as an ingredient, his company is helping both meat and plant-based companies alike to produce better and more efficient products. Shapiro also offers a candid take on cultivated meat, looking both at its promise and its hurdles. I'm Alex Crisp, and welcome to another episode of Future of Foods Interviews. You can listen to this and all episodes for free across all podcast platforms and on Substack. So please subscribe and leave your comments. Okay, so thank you, Paul Shapiro, for coming on Future Foods Interviews. You are CEO and co-founder of the Better Meat Company, a company that is producing an alternative meat protein through precision fermentation. Perhaps you'll explain to me a little bit more about that and introduce yourself a little bit. Over to you.
Alex, so great to be with you. I like your last name, by the way. Nobody's ever going to accuse you of being dull or soft. You're always going to be crisp. I like it. It's good. So I really appreciate your interest in talking about what the Better Meat Co. does. We harness the power of biomass fermentation in order to create a novel ingredient. It's called Rhiza Mycoprotein. And Rhiza Mycoprotein is a whole food that has a naturally meat-like texture that on its own has more protein than eggs, and it's a complete protein, meaning it has all the essential amino acids. It's got more iron than beef, more zinc than beef, more potassium than bananas, more fiber than oats. It is a true superfood. And so you get all the things about meat that you want, the texture, the protein. You don't, though, get the things you don't want, the saturated fat, the cholesterol, the animal cruelty, and so much environmental degradation, and so on. And this ingredient, Rhiza Mycoprotein, we can use both to put into meat to make meat better, to create meat that has a better texture and a better nutritional profile and is more cost effective, or you can use it to make alternative meats as well, in the same way you might use plant proteins right now to do that. And if we put it into a powder, we can use it also for sports and active nutrition. So it can go into bars, smoothies, baked goods, and more. So it's a really versatile ingredient. It's already generally recognized as safe by the FDA and approved by USDA as safe and suitable for inclusion in animal meat. And we're scaling up now. We're excited. We're going to be bringing this novel crop to the world in the coming year.
Okay, so this Rhiza Mycoprotein is an ingredient. It's not a product in itself necessarily that will be sold to consumers.
That's right. You can eat it on its own. It's fine. I do it every day, actually, myself, and I really like it. But the Better Meat Co. is a B2B ingredients company. We are not trying to compete with meat companies. We are trying to supply meat companies to help them make better meat. We're not trying to compete with plant-based meat companies. We want to help them make better meat as well. We're not trying to compete with any CPG brand out there. We want to be their supplier. In the same way that you can go, let's say, for example, now to Cargill or ADM, and you can buy soy protein and pea protein and wheat protein, we are offering mycoprotein as an ingredient. And there's nobody on earth right now that is really meaningfully commercializing a B2B mycoprotein ingredient. Not ADM, not Kerry, not Cargill, not Ingredion, not Roquette. None of the major ingredient suppliers offer any fungi proteins at all. They offer animal proteins or they offer plant proteins, but nothing in the fungi protein world. And we are building a fungi protein ingredient powerhouse at the Better Meat Co.
Okay, so what is it? What is it that you'd be offering to a meat company that perhaps they're lacking, or perhaps you think that they're lacking, that they could add this to their meat?
Sure. Well, think about meat right now, Alex. Right now, when you cook meat, let's say you start with 100 grams of meat and you're going to cook it. Most likely, you're going to end up with about 70 grams of meat after cooking, because there's a lot of loss there's a lot of yield loss when you cook. When you add Rhiza Mycoprotein, instead of having 70 grams at the end, you're going to have about 85 grams at the end. So right there, that's a 15% increase in your yield But it gets even better because the rhizomycin protein is more cost effective than the beef itself. So you get the double cost savings and you're improving the nutritionals. So when you add rhizomycin protein to beef, you end up getting less saturated fat, less cholesterol, fewer calories, more fiber, but you maintain the same level of protein. And so again, you're getting all the things about meat that you want: protein, iron, zinc, texture, and so on. But you get rid of some of the things you don't want, like so much cholesterol and saturated fat. And again, it's cost effective. For so long, alternative proteins have been a green premium where you have to pay more in order to utilize them. In our case, they're paying less.
That's interesting. So, what was it that inspired you to found the Better Meat Company? It's quite a niche sort of product, isn't it? What brought you into
I saw a white space. The reality, Alex, is that the world isn't getting any bigger. Humanity's footprint on the planet is getting a lot bigger, but the planet itself is remaining stubbornly the same size. And today we have more than 8 billion humans walking the planet. And if projections are correct, within the next 25 years, there's going to be another 2 billion of us added to the planet, and then we'll be up to 10 billion. So where are we going to get the land? Although those extra 2 billion people are going to want to eat as well, right? In fact, the 8 billion who are here now are also going to want to eat more meat, most likely, because they're getting wealthier and wealthier. And generally, when people become wealthier, they eat a more meat-centric diet. So between increasing wealth, which is increasing meat demand, and increasing human population, which is going to increase demand even further, where are we going to get the land in order to grow the crops and the animals who are needed to satiate that meat demand? We're not going to be farming the moon. We're not going to be farming Mars. We have one celestial body to farm, and that's right here on Earth. And if we don't want to deforest the rest of the Earth in order to raise more and more animals for food, we have to do something. And I would love it if people wanted to eat more lentil soup and bean and rice burritos and hummus wraps. That's great. I eat those foods myself and I really enjoy them. But the trends are going in the other way. Everywhere where it's going to matter the most in the future, meat demand is going up, not down. China, India, Brazil, Mexico, meat demand again is going up, not down in those places. And so I believe that one of the ways that we can help to sustainably satiate humanity's meat tooth, so to speak, is to create really stellar ingredients that we can add to meat that you can make it go much further while being even more nutritious and more cost effective. And so it's a win-win. There's no sacrifice associated with it. In the past, things that you've added to meat have generally been low quality ingredients that subtract from the nutritional qualities of the meat. They may reduce the amount of protein and so on. In our case, you're maintaining or increasing the protein while at the same time reducing the things about it that you don't want, again, like saturated fat and cholesterol. And so the reason I started this company was frankly because I don't see many other ways that we are going to avert any type of crisis with regard to how we're going to feed humanity in the future without getting a lot more efficient about how we produce meat today. The reason why we're up to 8 billion is because of gains in agricultural efficiency through the Green Revolution and subsequent optimizations on crops and animals since then. But we can't stop. Human population continues to go up, so we need to get more and more efficient. And I believe that harnessing the power of biomass fermentation to grow fungi proteins is a key way that we're going to do that.
Okay, so is your mycoprotein, is that adding, has that got a sort of umami flavor that can add to plant-based foods and that sort of thing?
Yes, the rhizomycoprotein that we grow doesn't taste like nothing. It has a slight umami flavor. And so you can actually, when you're using it as an ingredient, you don't have to add as much flavoring to your product because it already has an umami flavor. Keep in mind, it is fungi, right? It's going to have a slight umami flavor, as fungi often do. So yes, there is a flavor advantage when you're adding this to meat or plant-based meat as well.
And is that the main advantage for plant-based foods, or I suppose you talk, it's a microprotein, so it's kind of adding something to plant-based foods that is otherwise lacking as well, but kind of different to
Yeah.
how it's adding to meat, I suppose.
I think that's right. I mean, think about plant-based meat today, which is still really in the dumps when it comes to market takeover, right? Like, if you look at plant-based milk, it's gotten to about 15% market share of the fluid milk market in the United States. Plant-based meat, on the other hand, is still at less than 1%. Less than one single percent of the meat industry in the US is plant-based, and around the world, it's even lower. It's not even a rounding error in the meat industry. And so the question is why? Billions of dollars have been spent in order to try to promote plant-based meat and advance it. And still, it's languishing at less than 1% of the market. And the reason is what I call the three P's. You've got price, it's just a lot more expensive than meat is. You got performance, it often doesn't taste as good as meat. And you have the perception. There are some people who perceive it as a processed food, right? Rice and mycoprotein is the antidote to all three of those problems. It's cheaper than beef. It is much better in terms of texture and performance compared to plant protein isolates. And it's not only not ultra processed, it's not processed, right? This is a whole food that is intact. In fact, it's more of a, it's not the equivalent of eating, let's say, the entire pea. It is the equivalent of eating the entire pea plant, the roots, the leaves, everything. So just to back up, like if you think about, take peas as an example, since we're on that topic. The way that you make a plant-based burger today is you have to grow a field of peas, harvest a field of peas, mill it into a flour, but that flour is very low in protein. So you got to strip out the fiber, strip out the fat, concentrate it down into a pea protein powder, like a pea protein isolate that an athlete might take as a supplement, but that still does not get you the texture of meat. So then you've got to subject it to twin screw extrusion, which is a fancy way of saying lots of heat and lots of pressure to change the structure of the protein. And you get then your hero ingredient, texturized pea protein, and you add a couple dozen other ingredients to it, and you get your plant-based burger. Mycoprotein, on the other hand, is simply a fermentation process that at the end of the fermentation, you get a product that has a naturally meat-like texture and that can remain as a whole food. No fractionation, no isolation, no extrusion. None of that is necessary in order to make mycoprotein taste and have the texture of a meat type product with that type of chew. And so you can ultimately reduce cost in this way because you don't have to use just a tiny fraction of the pea that has multiple processes subjected to it. You can use the whole food as it comes out of the fermenter. And unlike a cow, who takes, let's say, nearly 2 years of feeding before you get a steak, our mycoprotein can be grown in less than one single day. So from the time that we inoculate our fermenter to the time that we harvest our fermenter is less than one single day, making it among the most efficient and sustainable proteins that can be possibly grown on Earth.
Okay, so it has the potential to complete. So using this product, you can make a whole burger with this product. It hasn't got to be mixed with other products. It can be a burger in itself.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, but I think you would want to add some flavoring to it,
Okay.
and there's not, it's not going to have the flavor of a burger on its own. It'll have an umami flavor, but not like a burger. So you'd need to do that. But the bigger use case for this is to add it to ground beef that's going into burgers, right? So you could take, think for example, Alex, about Burger King. Right now, you walk in and you have two options essentially. You can get the Whopper, which is solely made of beef, or you can get the Impossible Whopper, which is 0% beef. Now, what if in addition to the Whopper, you just made the, excuse me, in addition to the Whopper that Impossible is making, right? The Impossible Whopper, what if the conventional Whopper, let's say, was 20% mycoprotein and 80% beef? In that case, you could bring the cost of the burger down. You would bring the saturated fat and cholesterol down, you bring the fiber up, the protein would remain the same, and it would have a better texture. That's the promise of the mycoprotein that we're growing.
Okay. And are you working with the likes of Burger King in with this sort of ambition?
We certainly have that ambition, and we're working with many of the biggest food companies on Earth. At the same time, we're a small company. We're running a demonstration scale plant out of Sacramento, California, where we could never even dream of supplying a company like Burger King. To rectify that, we are now scaling up, and we're in the process of building our full-scale factory where we will be able to produce over 1,000 tons of dry mycelium every single year. That is the first step for us to getting big enough in order to supply a company like Burger King. But we're going to start with that, and then we'll go from there and make sure that we can continue scaling this incredibly important ingredient for the future of humanity.
So yeah, I mean, I've written and I've discussed with a number of people about the idea of blended meats, and there's so many ways to blend. There's the kind of cultivated fats, such as the ones produced by Mission Barns and
Right.
people like that, and mixing that with plant-based and your products. And I know Meatable, they were talking about kind of mixing their cultivated meat with actual meat. And so I guess this is one more version of a blended meat. Do you think blended meats are going to be a common sight in supermarkets in the future?
Yeah, I think that meats that are enhanced with non-animal ingredients are going to become more and more common. In the past, we've had a very different view of what meat is, right? Like meat in the past has generally meant a hunk of flesh from a slaughtered animal. In the future, though, I think people are going to have a far more diverse view of what meat is. So it won't just be a hunk of flesh from a slaughtered animal. I don't doubt that that will still exist, but you're also going to have meat that comes from plants, meat that comes from animal cells, meat that comes from fungi, and hybrids thereof, right? So you could have a burger that, let's say, is 50% beef from a cow and 50% mycoprotein, or maybe it'll have some type of cultivated fat or protein source also. Those companies still have some ways to go to scale, but maybe in the future that will be true. I like to think of a world where we could have meat essentially on demand. So think about it like this, Alex. Right now, if you went to your friend's house and she had on her kitchen counter an ice cream maker or a bread maker, you wouldn't think twice. But what if she had a meat maker? What if there were a meat maker on her counter and she could drop in a little tea bag full of, let's say, fungi spores, drop them in, and come back the next day and have freshly brewed meat on your kitchen counter? That's the type of future that I think will be really cool to live in. It would be ultra efficient, and we could spare billions of animals from going through suffering that most of us don't want to think about. So I'm excited about helping build that type of a future. And I could also envision this as being not just important for feeding us here on Earth, but also for feeding astronauts in space. Right now, if we're going to go on long distance cosmic tourism, they're not going to bring Noah's Ark in tow. If they want to eat meat on long distance space travel, they're going to have to grow it. Well, what better way than to start by perfecting these technologies here and now?
Yeah, that is interesting, isn't it? I mean, I've discussed the ideas of 3D printing meats and kind of various, in the future. So you can have a 3D printer on your kitchen worktop and kind of print whatever sort of meat you like using, sort of cell growth. But yes, the idea of raising it from spores. I've actually The majority of my Christmas presents this year is going to be some kind of fermented food stuff. So
Ah,
I'm
cool.
making lots of kimchi and lots of I have some mushrooms fermenting as well. So I suppose,
Wow,
it's
Alex, I'm envious that I'm not on your Christmas gift list. I wish that I could be on there and get that, but maybe when we're in Chicago together, you'll smuggle some kimchi into the US.
imagine if I tried to do that. What might So you've raised plenty of money for your company. What's the secret then to be able to your success in fundraising?
Well, yeah, let me offer a couple of thoughts on that, Alex. So, first of all, our company from inception to present has raised about $43 million. I know that sounds like a lot of money. Of course, it is a lot of money. But in the context of biotech startups, and especially in the context of mycelium startups in our own sector, frankly, it's not that much. You look at a company like Nature's Find, the largest and best funded of the mycelium companies, they've raised about $500 million. You look at Meaty, which raised almost $400 million. You look at Enough in Europe, which raised, probably close to my guess would be around $150, $200 million so far. So, in all honesty, compared to other mycelium startups, we are not that well funded. At the same time, one thing we are excellent at doing is stretching dollars to make them go further. And I believe that to the extent that we have had success in fundraising, it has been because we have a strong idea, a great team implementing that idea, and we are not trying to do too many things. It's very difficult to invent a new technology. It's very difficult to build a brand from zero. Those are two different skill sets. And there's an investor who I like. His name is Brian Frank from FTW Ventures. And he had a really good line that I appreciated. Brian said that he likes to bet on companies that only have to perform one miracle. And being good at inventing technology is a miracle. Being good at running your own manufacturing facility at industrial scale, that's another skill set, and that's a miracle. Being good at building a brand is also a miracle. Like, these are all different miracles that you have to do. And for those companies that are trying to build CPG brands based on a novel ingredient, you have to do all of them. Now, I'm not saying it's not possible. For example, Korn, Quorn, in the UK did this, right? It took them decades, but they did it. They built a novel ingredient, they built a brand around it, and they have scores upon scores of SKUs that they successfully sell. So I'm not saying it can't be done, but I think it's much harder to do that, to try to self-manufacture, invent the technology, build the CPG brand. It's just really, really difficult. We, on the other hand, at the Better Meat Co., are really focused just on technology creation. We're focused on creating new tech that offers promise, patenting that technology, and then handing it off to a contract manufacturer who can produce it for us, and maybe we'll license that technology at some point in the future too. We're open to that, but we aren't trying to create a vertically integrated company that, is going to have a brand on the shelf. We are sticking in our own lane, and I think that's one thing that makes us more attractive to investors.
Yeah. So you have GRAS status with the FDA now. So does that mean you are selling your products? Are you you and so you are kind of commercially producing a product and selling it to customers?
That's right. So the FDA determined that they have no questions about our declaration of GRAS, or generally recognized as safe. And what that means is that we could start selling, and we do sell. We sell hundreds of thousands of dollars of product, but that's all we can produce. It's not like, if somebody came to us with more orders, we wouldn't be able to fulfill them. That happens all the time. Demand for our product vastly exceeds supply of it. We have a small plant in Sacramento, which, we have a 9,000-liter fermenter, which is great. It's big for a small startup, but it's nowhere near what you need for commercial volumes, right? Commercial volumes, these companies have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of liters. And so that's what we need to get to in order to start generating the type of revenue where we're going to actually not only become a profitable company, but make the dent in the world that we're seeking to make, which is to actually start reducing total demand for animals as a food source. I will note, though, that in the US, there are only three species of mycoprotein that have ever been approved as GRAS by FDA. There's corn, which is Fusarium vetinatum. There's Nature's Find, which is Fusarium flavolopus. And then there's the Better Meat Co., which is Neurospora crassa. So if you look, though, at the other GRAS applications, they explicitly do not seek or are allowed to put their mycoprotein into meat. The Better Meat Co. is the only company that has gotten approval by USDA to consider our mycoprotein as safe and suitable for inclusion in animal meat. So as of this moment, our mycoprotein is literally the only mycoprotein on Earth that the USDA allows to be put into animal meat and is considered safe and suitable. So that's a big advantage for us. I imagine it won't be forever, but we're working to scale up quickly so that meat companies can benefit from that.
And and your customers now, are they meat companies or are they plant-based companies?
Well, it's both. So I'll give you an example. Oshi, which is the plant-based salmon company, uses our ingredient in their product to make their plant-based salmon. But most of the companies we work with, admittedly, are meat companies. We sell to meat companies because they are we see a much bigger addressable market and a much bigger mission for us. We don't care to just, be another plant-based meat, although that's great. If the Beyonds and Impossibles of the world want to buy from us, we're of course happy to sell to them. But our real goal is to partner with the largest meat companies on Earth in order to help them use fewer animals.
So people like Cargill, JBS, that sort of thing.
That's exactly right, Alex. We'd love to sell to both of them so that the patties that they're making and the burgers, the sausages, the nuggets, all of it don't have to be solely made of meat. Products that are solely meat are inferior to products that have been enhanced with mycoprotein. And we want to help these companies make better meat by using mycoprotein.
And you said Oshi. Are they an Israeli company, or are they, yeah?
They are, yes. Oshi is based in Israel, but they're selling in the US.
Okay. Okay. So how are you finding, how are people, I know, the kind of general consensus, I suppose, with consumers and politically in the US, how is it with precision fermented proteins? Do you think it's going to be readily accepted, or do you think there might be some, that there might be some resistance?
I don't think that most people think about what type of fermentation was used. I mean, I'll put it this way. Like, think about Impossible Burgers and Beyond Burgers. Impossible is made with soy and Beyond is made with pea. Does any consumer know that or care about that? I don't know. Maybe there's some small group who do. Maybe there's some who don't want soy for whatever reason, but I think most people don't care. The same is true, let's say, with biomass fermentation, like what we do. I think most people don't know or care what biomass fermentation is. They want to know, is this product taste good? Is it nutritious? Does it meet the needs that I have in terms of cost effectiveness? That's what I think most people care about. And so I doubt that the average person who might pick up a product with our ingredient in it even contemplates the style of fermentation that was used when they bought it.
Yeah, I mean, you would have been aware that in Europe recently it nearly went through that in the EU that you couldn't use terms like meat and burger and sausage
Right, yes.
to kind of label non-meat products. How would that have affected you, or how would that affect you if something like that came into America, and how likely is that to come into America?
I think it's highly unlikely in the US. There have been laws passed at certain states that prohibit or restrict the sale of cultivated meat from animal cells. But in terms of restrictions on the use of the terms like, plant-based burger or soy-based meatball and so on, I see that as unlikely. And frankly, I don't think it's good to do, but I also don't think it impacts the Better Meat Co that much. Most of the products that we're going into are actual meat, right? They're going into a beef-based burger. It's not like that is going to be restricted in that way. So I'm less concerned about it for our company. On the other hand, though, I do want to stress, these policies that are being proposed in Europe and perhaps elsewhere are designed for one thing and one thing only, which is to protect the incumbent meat industry. Consumers are not confused. When they see something that's labeled as a plant-based burger, they don't wonder what it's made out of. It's not like when, somebody buys a hamburger, are they thinking, oh, was this made out of ham? Of course not. There's no ham in it. When they buy peanut butter, they're not thinking, is there dairy in it, even though it's called butter? Nobody thinks about that. When they buy hot dogs, they don't think dogs are in there. And the list goes on and on, right? So I just think it's much ado about very little. It's not about protecting consumers from confusion. It's about protecting cattlemen from competition. And I worry about this not that much, but overall, I do think that there will continue to be tensions as meat becomes diversified, and there will be some incumbents who want to maintain the status quo. It would be almost like imagine if Kodak had tried to restrict digital from being called photography, right? Like, does it really matter? I mean, I don't know. People like digital pictures, whether you call them photos, pictures, or something else, right? I just don't know that it matters as much as some people think it does.
Yeah, because you said that the plant-based market in the US is less than 1%, and yet there seems to be resistance from the meat industry to possibly trying to kind of discredit plant-based foods, perhaps, or kind of cultivated meat foods. And yet, at the same time, kind of cultivated meat foods and plant-based meat foods do like to use the term meat in their names.
Yeah, I think it's fine to do that. And I want to point out, the meat industry is not monolithic, right? So we talk about like, oh, there's resistance from the meat industry. A lot of the players in the meat industry are supportive and part of this. I mean, Johnsonville Sausage, the biggest sausage brand in America, is one of our investors. Tyson, Cargill, Hormel, they've all invested in these types of plant-based innovations. So many of the actual like CPG brands are part of this movement and wanting to diversify because they don't want to become the next Kodak. You look at what happened, Kodak and Canon both knew about digital. They were both vying for supremacy in the photography market, and Kodak was afraid that digital would cannibalize its core business of selling, all the chemicals that are needed to process photos, the print paper, the negatives, all that. And Canon thought, this is going to cannibalize our business, but we think it's the future, and so they embraced it. And we all know what happened. Canon became the largest digital camera maker on Earth, and Kodak went bankrupt. You see this time and time again. Blockbuster Video could have gotten on board with digital, with streaming. They didn't, though. They thought it would cannibalize their core business of video rental stores, which it did. But still, if they had gotten on board and acquired Netflix when they had a chance to, they might not have ceased to exist as they have now, right? So, there are meat companies that don't want to be the next Blockbuster. They don't want to be the next Kodak. They want to be the next Canon or the next Netflix. They don't care so much about where the meat is coming from, right? It's kind of like light. When you walk into a room, you don't think about where the light is coming from. You're glad the room is lit, but you don't care. You're not thinking, is this coming from oil or gas or wind or solar? You're just glad that the room is illuminated. And I think it's true for many people when they eat meat. When they eat meat, many people aren't thinking, oh, I'm so glad that an animal was slaughtered for this, right? They just want something that tastes good, that is cost effective, and that's nutritious for them. Now, admittedly, I think there are some people who care, but I think most people are just happy to eat something that tastes great and is safe and is cost effective for them. And so I think many of the meat companies recognize this. Now, admittedly, Alex, I agree with you. Some of the meat companies, especially the cattle growers and so on, are oftentimes resistant to this type of innovation. But many of them aren't. Many of them would like to be a part of this transformation. And instead of going the way of the horse-drawn carriage, they could be part of the new Ford enterprise of creating horseless carriages too.
So, it was interesting you said that when people eat meat, they're not thinking, oh, it's great that an animal was killed for this. But maybe if they're eating meat and they know that an animal wasn't killed for it, they'll be saying, oh, great, an animal wasn't killed for this. So,
I hope so.
and is that part of the drive, that and maybe sort of sustainability and the environment? Is there any part of that's involved in your business or the company?
It certainly motivates me, but whether it motivates the average person, I don't know. I think of these generally as like tertiary concerns for people when they're considering what types of foods to purchase. I'll give you an example. Most people are concerned about themselves first, obviously, we all are. And if we were only concerned about ourselves, we would only be buying the food that's healthiest for us, right? But the last I checked, French fries and potato chips and burgers are still pretty popular. And so if knowing that foods that are bad for us isn't enough to get us to eat fewer of them, is it also then going to be enough to say, well, it's actually bad for the planet or it's bad for animals? I think for most people, probably not. I think these are nice to haves, but not must haves for most people. Most people just want something that tastes good, is cost effective, and is nutritious, right? And probably in that order. So, taste, price, convenience, et cetera, I still think those are like king and queen when it comes to what motivates people's food choices. And these other concerns about the planet or animal welfare or even personal health really are often tertiary for most people. Not all, not all. There's some people who really care deeply, but I think most people, that's true.
Yeah, I heard somewhere recently that using the word sustainability in your marketing has become a kind of toxic idea.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, I would imagine that may be true in like, America. It seems like in Western Europe, that's perhaps not as true. I don't know. I think, if you look at what EVs did, like electric vehicles, they didn't market themselves as being, hey, this is a better for the planet car. They marketed themselves like Tesla did, as a cool, awesome, better car that happens to also not run on fossil fuels. And I think we need to do the same with these types of alternative, what are now today alternative products. Make it clear that they are better. If you look at the displacement of animals in the economy, never has an animal exploitative enterprise been displaced because of humane concerns or because of environmental concerns, right? The reason we stopped whipping horses to get us around wasn't because we cared about the horses. It's that horseless carriages, or what we now call cars, were invented and they're a better way. We used to live pluck geese in order to write letters with their quills. We didn't stop because we cared about the geese. We stopped because metal fountain pens were invented and it's a better way to write. We used to harpoon whales to light our homes with whale oil. We didn't stop because we cared about whales. We stopped because kerosene was invented and it was a cheaper way to light our homes. And that list goes on and on and on and on, right? And so it's not like the ways that animals have been displaced in the past has really been because of moral arguments for the most part. For the most part, it's just been because of new technologies that render the old way of doing things obsolete. And I suspect that if we do see a substantial reduction in the number of animals used for food, it's going to be because of new technology and less because of ethical arguments.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? So it's like human beings are inherently cruel, but they are, very good at inventing new technology to make their lives easier, which almost as a kind of side effect is good for the
Yeah,
animal.
I mean, I think that human beings can oftentimes be extremely cruel, and the evidence of this is so overwhelming it needs not to be enumerated. At the same time, most people today would not be that keen on doing the things to animals that we do to them to get them ready to be consumed, right? Most people would not be. Think about all the male cows and all the male pigs are castrated without painkiller, as an example. I think most people would never dream of castrating a pig or a cow or a bull without anesthesia themselves. Most people would never dream of cutting their throats open, even to slaughter them. But so it's not that most people in this case are cruel. But it's more that most people generally are going to go with the flow, and they're going to do what is convenient, what's cost effective, what they like, what tastes good. And so, because this type of animal cruelty is out of sight and out of mind, it becomes easier, and there's less cognitive dissonance associated with it. But admittedly, I think, many people can be cruel. Obviously, that's true. But what we need to do is make it so that the better choice, the ethically preferable choice, is also the more convenient choice. And that is how we generally have seen moral progress happen in the past. Even in the US, like don't forget about this topic. Go back to something like something as terrible as slavery. There's a reason why the northern states peacefully legislated slavery out of existence, whereas the southern states were willing to go to war to prevent slavery from being eradicated. That's because the northern states had industrialized and they were no longer dependent on an agricultural system for their economy. So once you remove that type of feeling of necessity for people, it becomes a lot easier to accept that something may be morally questionable, like slavery. And of course, today, thankfully, everybody agrees slavery was an abomination. But back then, that wasn't the case. Back then, a huge portion of society thought slavery was normal and natural. I mean, slavery has existed in almost every single human society, from the Romans, the Greeks, the Egyptians. Like, it's not like slavery was just in America. And it took a change in the economy toward industrialization to make it easier for people to accept that maybe slavery wasn't such a good idea. And I think the same is true here. Once we have new technologies that render us less dependent on animals as a food source, maybe people will look at what we've done to animals in a different way. And they'll think, yeah, this isn't such a good idea. And maybe in future generations, they will be grateful that they no longer are dependent so heavily on animals as a food source because of new technologies that were invented, just like we are grateful that our society is no longer based on slavery.
Well, we are grateful, but we're also horrified that our ancestors used to do that. And so perhaps in, I don't know, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, they'll look back and say, what, you used to kill animals and eat their flesh and kind of suckle their teats? How weird.
I suspect that that may be true. I think it's very easy for us to condemn our ancestors for things that they believed or things that they did. Yet in their time, that was totally normal. I mean, it's not just slavery. Look at, let's say, 100 years ago in our country, or let's say 110 years ago in our country, in the United States. The big debate was whether more than half of people should even be able to vote, right? Like, well, whether women should be able to vote. And many of the people leading the charge against women's suffrage were women. Think about how laughable that would be today, but that was the case just a century ago in the United States. Half a century ago in the United States, the big public policy debate was whether whites and blacks should be able to share the same drinking fountains and get on the bus together. Like, these are things that are laughable to us today. Like, we could never even imagine possibly advocating for those positions today. But just a half century ago, that was a normal position for people to have. You could be a respectable member of society and believe in racial segregation. You could be a doctor, a lawyer, a member of Congress and believe in that. But imagine today if you were to say, oh no, I think women shouldn't be able to vote, or I think we should keep the races segregated, or I believe in human bondage, right? Like these are positions that a blink of an eye ago, historically speaking, were totally normal to hold. And today, thankfully, we've moved on and we now view them as abominable positions to hold. But I don't think the progress stops. I do think that what you're saying, Alex, is probably right, that 50 years from now, they're going to be looking back on us and thinking, geez, they really believed in some pretty barbaric stuff.
Yeah.
And treatment of animals who are raised for food may be at the top of that list.
I've heard women recently, my mother's age, say that they think that kind of women's suffrage went a little bit too far. So it's I don't know how far away from that we are. So yeah. So anyway, so in regard to your company, where do you see it in 5 years from now? I mean, what's the idea of what would be the idea of success for you? Where would you like to be?
There will be a robust mycoprotein ingredient industry that the Better Meat Co. is leading, and we are going to be producing thousands of tons of mycelium ingredients that food companies can use to enhance their products. Right now, companies have ample choices if they want to pick plant proteins or animal proteins. They can get chicken meat, crab meat, pork, beef, turkey, and so on, or they can get soy, wheat, pea, whatever. They can't get fungi proteins. It's not an existing industry as a B2B industry for ingredients right now, despite the obvious advantages that fungi offer in many different food product applications. We're going to create that industry. We are going to become like a Cargill as an ingredient supplier, except based on mycelial ingredients that will offer really innovative, stellar ways to replace animals in the food system to improve the health of the products that we're eating and reduce humanity's footprint on the planet.
Okay. And how close do you think you'll be to that within the next 5 years?
My aspirations are very high. I'm very bullish on our ability to do great things, Alex. And I do think that in 5 years, what I just said will be true.
That's really great. I like the idea of that. So apart from your company and apart from what you're doing, this is the last question, and then I'll let you go. What innovation that's out there at the moment in the world of alternative proteins are you most excited about?
There are so many of them. So obviously mycoprotein is one, no doubt. But at the same time, I also am really excited about some of the choice architecture work that's going on that is helping people eat more plant-based without having to invent new technology at all. As an example, it used to be believed that at restaurants that having a vegetarian section on the menu is preferable. Now it turns out that actually, if you want to increase uptake of those vegetarian options, it's better to intermingle them in the menu, not to have a separate vegetarian section so that everybody, not just vegetarians, will look at that section. Similarly, there are entire school districts and hospitals like in New York City where they're doing a default plant-based option. So the default option for the patients is to get plant-based. They can request meat if they want, but in the past it's been default meat and you can request a plant-based option. Now, this is simple choice architecture, but it really does seem to have an impact without taking away anybody's choices. It just gives them making it the easier choice for them to choose to eat plant-based. And so those type of efforts that are going on in the public policy realm, I'm pretty enthusiastic about as a way to help move us in the right direction. There are plenty of technologies also that I'm excited about, but choice architecture, I am pretty bullish on to help achieve some of the goals that the technology is intended to achieve also.
Okay. Well, that sounds great. And I look forward very much to watching your progress and the progress of the Better Meat Company. And I look forward to meeting you in Chicago in February.
I can't wait, Alex. It's going to be fun.
It should be fun.
Make sure you smuggle in the kimchi for me, okay?
I'm not even going to go near that idea. No.
You're going to.
But I would like to try some of your products if you can bring that along.
I think I might be able to smuggle that onto a plane. We'll see.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming on Future of Foods interviews, and Yes, have a good rest of your day.
Great to talk with you, Alex.